We're turning now to 1 Samuel, chapter 13, continuing the story of Saul. Up to this point, Saul has been mostly viewed in a positive light. He has been chosen by the prophet of God, or by God himself, to be the king. He's been reticent about it. He's not spoken about it to his family. When it came time for him to be coronated, he was shy and was hiding. God had to reveal to the people where to find him. So he really has been rather meek and unassuming. So he's kind of endearing in a way to us. Unfortunately, though, he makes some bad choices with reference to actual obedience to God, which get him into trouble with God. And then his situation gets worse and worse, and he becomes worse and worse. In chapter 12, Samuel gave his parting address, basically bowing out now that there was a new king. Saul was officially installed, and Samuel, who had been guiding the country as their judge and a prophet, was now saying, okay, I'm not going to stop praying for you, but I'm going to be, you know, kind of going into semi-retirement, and you now have this king. Now, the king was nonetheless required to obey God. Even though God had never really wanted them to have a king, once they got a king, they had a choice. They could be a theocracy under a secondary monarch. That is, they're still governed by God, but through a king, an earthly king. But that would mean the earthly king has to be getting his orders from God. Or else, they could have an earthly king who didn't obey God, which means they'd be a nation in rebellion against God, just like the pagans. So it's very important for Saul to be completely obedient to God. For him to act on his own volition is simply to act like other kings did. And once you become a king, you might begin to model your behavior after other kings of other nations. And that is apparently how Saul began to think. After all, he was in a role that had no precedent. There had never been a king over God's people before. So one might naturally, if thrust into that position, not know intuitively how to operate, although he should know that he has to obey God. And that's the one thing he was held responsible for, which he failed to do. If he became a monarch of a nation, he might just think, well, what does a monarch do? And the only models he would have would be the monarchs of the pagan nations, which obviously was not the model he was to follow. And therefore, while one could understand his confusion, he still acted inexcusably, as we shall see in chapter 13. Saul reigned, it says, 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul chose himself 3,000 men of Israel. 2,000 were with Saul in Michmash in the mountains of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent. Now, he'd had a big group of people, about 300,000 or something, had gathered against the Ammonites, and he had conquered them. And now he didn't retain such a large army as that. One might think a king would like to do so, because that's pretty powerful, but you have to pay for them too, you know, and so they didn't really have that kind of a budget. So he kept and retained a standing army of 3,000 men, of which he kept 2/3 of them under his direct command, and a third of them were put under the command of his son, who we hear of for the first time here, Jonathan. Jonathan obviously becomes an important character in the story later, but until this point, we didn't know that Saul had a son. And the fact that he had a son old enough to command 1,000 troops means that Saul himself couldn't have been much younger than 40, and may have been older than 40 when he became king. And he actually reigned for 40 years, according to two sources. The Old Testament doesn't tell us the length of Saul's reign, but Josephus said that he reigned for 40 years. Now, Josephus, of course, is not an inspired author, and he may have had the same sources Paul had for his information, because Paul said the same thing in Acts chapter 13 and verse 21. Paul is preaching, and he says in Acts 13:21. Afterward, they asked for a king. So God gave them Saul, the son of Kish, a man of the tribe of Benjamin, for 40 years. So The length of Saul's reign, according to Paul and Josephus, was 40 years, although we don't have that information in the Old Testament. One reason we don't have it in the Old Testament is because probably of the corruption of verse 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 13. Scholars tell us that there are 2 years here. Of course, we read Saul reigned 1 year, and when he reigned 2 years over Israel, etc. There has been corruption of both of those numbers, and the first one has fallen out of the text entirely. In other words, in the Hebrew text, there is no number there. Apparently, the New King James supplied the number 1 for some reason, because the second number was taken to be 2. But literally in the Hebrew, it says, Saul reigned blank year. And so it doesn't really say. That means, of course, the text, which originally had the number, has somehow been corrupted. Some copyist miscopied it. Or maybe someone was working with an older manuscript that had the number, but a moth had eaten a hole through that point, and there's no number there, so they just left it blank. There are different, or it's smeared, or the parchment had molded and became illegible. And so we have, in our present manuscript condition, no number there. It's very possible that the original number there was 40. That is, that Saul reigned 40 years. That would agree with Josephus and with Paul in the New Testament. Now, we might say, well, the fact that Paul said it means it's true. Well, not necessarily. Just because it records that Paul said something doesn't mean that he was inspired when he said it. Not every time Paul opened his mouth was he inspired. Not even every time that his words are recorded were they inspired. For example, we read of him and his friends having a disagreement about whether he should go to Jerusalem or not. And there's some argument to be made that Paul was mistaken in choosing to go there when it says certain men through the Spirit told him not to go. So Paul might have been right or he might have been wrong. In telling us that Paul said a certain thing, it's not saying that he was necessarily right. It's just telling us what he said. And although we'd like to think that every time Paul preached, he almost came under the influence of the Spirit like a prophet of God and speaks oracles, but he didn't claim that for himself, and the Bible doesn't claim it for him. But I would still trust him if he gives a number that he had good reason to believe that it was the correct number. And he and Josephus both felt that Saul reigned for 40 years and may have done so because they had earlier copies of the Old Testament than we have, copies that still had the correct number here. It... 1 Samuel 13, 1. So I'm going to suggest that it originally said Saul reigned 40 years. That's a summary of his reign. And then it begins to talk about something that happened in the second year of his reign. When he had reigned 2 years over Israel, he selected 3,000 choice men to be his standing army or bodyguard. Jonathan here is given charge over 1,000 of them. So Jonathan must have been a mature man. Well, I should say probably a young man, but still mature enough to be given serious adult responsibilities. So Saul could not have been very young at this point. As I said, if Jonathan was even in his late teens, then Saul would almost certainly have to be pushing 40 at the youngest. And so if he was almost 40 when he began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years, then we would assume that he must have been close to 80 when he died. But we get ahead of ourselves. So here we have this army divided between Saul and Jonathan, and the rest of the people he sent away, every man to his tent. Verse 3, and Jonathan attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba, and the Philistines heard of it. Then Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, let the Hebrews hear. Now all Israel heard it said that Saul had attacked a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel had also become an abomination to the Philistines, and the people were called together to Saul at Gilgal. Now apparently Jonathan acted on his own. We shall see other stories about Jonathan that suggest he was a man who took initiative. Like at a later point, he and his armor bearer alone just decided to attack a garrison of the Philistines. He was a man who was antsy for battle and zealous for the cause of Israel, and he had 1,000 men with him, and so they attacked a garrison of the Philistines at Geba. This was apparently a surprise to Saul. We don't read that Saul authorized it, or else if Saul was into it, he probably would have conducted the attack. He had 2,000 men, So this is something where Jonathan, as at other times, seemed to act on his own. But once he had attacked the garrison of the Philistines, of course, the other Philistines heard of it and said, oh, these Israelites want to make war. And the news got around that Saul had attacked the Philistines, which wasn't quite correct, but he was the king, so he was responsible. And so now he was thrust into war, a war that he had not initiated. But all the people came to him. Then the Philistines gathered together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and encamped in Michmash, or Michmash probably, to the east of Beth-Aven. And the men of Israel saw that they were in danger, for the people were distressed. Then the people hid in caves, in thickets, in rocks, in holes, in pits. So the Israelites were greatly outnumbered and outclassed by the Philistine military that had come against them. Apparently, the Philistines decided not to make the mistakes they'd made before and underestimate the power of Yahweh, because more than once Yahweh had come to Israel's aid against the Philistines, so they brought the largest number of troops they could, hoping to succeed against such a great power as Yahweh, against the people of Yahweh. And so the people then saw the numbers of Philistines, and instead of trusting in God, they just despaired and decided to hide in caves and such. Then it says in verse 7, and some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad, Gilead, as far as for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. Now, what it's saying is that the Jews, some of them are hiding in caves locally, others crossed the river to get away. And so Saul's army was melting away. They were defecting from him. He started out with only 2,000 with him, and now most of them are defecting, and he's got 30,000 chariots coming after him, as well as foot soldiers like the sand of the seashore. So he's really got occasion to be worried. But not if he remembers stories like that of Gideon and others. Jonathan knew that there was nothing to be afraid of, because, as I said later on, Jonathan and his armor bearer attacked a garrison of the Philistines by themselves, and just two men. And Jonathan encouraged his armor bearer in advance of that attack, saying, it's no big thing for God to deliver by many or by few. If God's for us, he can deliver these into our hands, just the two of us. So Jonathan had the faith of Gideon, attacking a much larger force than himself with very few on his side. But Saul, or at least the people that were with Saul, didn't have that kind of faith. And so they fled and deserted. And there were some still following Saul, but they followed him trembling. They were not a courageous military band. It was probably a ragtag group of the ones who were the bravest or the most stubborn who would not defect, but they weren't exactly confident in their prospects. Now it says, then he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering that Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him. Now, this meeting and this sacrifice was predicted much earlier, apparently at least 2 years earlier, when Samuel had first met Saul and given him the signs that he would see. These prophets would meet him, and they'd give him a couple loaves of bread, and some other prophets would meet him, and the Spirit would come upon him. These were the very first signs that God gave to Saul, predicted by Samuel. But at that same time, back in chapter 10 and verse 8, Samuel had said, you shall go down before me to Gilgal, and surely I will come down to you and offer burnt offerings and make sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait until I come to you and show you what you should do. Now, these instructions, as they are recorded here in chapter 10, do not sound like they're very explicit about when this will be. And it's possible that this is an abbreviated account. It's entirely possible that Samuel on this occasion told him what the occasion would be, when it would be, the time when you have to maybe when the Philistines and you are preparing to go to battle. Certainly the king of Israel would be expected to lead the armies of Israel against the Philistines, but the timing would be everything. And so it was that in the first 2 years, there was no confrontation between Saul and the Philistines, but the time came for it, and that time might have even been prescribed by Samuel on this earlier occasion. We just don't have all the details of it. But certainly we read that Samuel expected Saul to know that he was obligated to wait for 7 days for Samuel to come. Now, Saul was of the tribe of Benjamin and therefore was not even related to the families that were authorized to offer sacrifices. Only the Levites, and particularly the priesthood of Aaron, were allowed to offer sacrifices. And although Samuel was not actually of the line of Aaron, he was a Levite, and he had sort of filled in. God had raised him up to fill in when Eli and his sons had died. So Samuel was, had an established authority to offer sacrifices in the place of the high priest. But Saul had no such authority, so he was supposed to wait for the authorized agent. Now, you wouldn't go to battle without offering sacrifices to God first, because it was understood you need God on your side, especially when you're so outnumbered, as they were in this case. They need to appeal to God. They need to, atone for any offenses that God may be holding against them. They need to make sure that they've pleased God and that he's on their side. So they need to offer a sacrifice before they go into battle. And frankly, pagan nations would do the same thing to their gods. I mean, it was understood that a military encounter between two nations was really a conflict between the gods of different nations. That's how they understood things. So getting their gods on their side was something any nation would do before they went to war. Israel, of course, especially, but since they had a real God who could actually help them, were expected to do that and did that. But Saul realized that as Samuel had not arrived, he'd waited 7 days, and Samuel had not arrived. Now, clearly, Samuel arrived before that seventh day was over, because no sooner had Saul offered the sacrifice than Samuel shows up. So Saul just kind of gave up on waiting just a little too soon, apparently just an hour or two sooner than he should have. And he saw the people melting away. He saw his army, dispersing. And he thought, well, if this goes on any longer, there's going to be no one here left. I'd better get things moving. I'll offer this sacrifice. Maybe it'll bring cohesion. And it seems like something that we'd think, well, that's really, understandable. Samuel didn't show up when he said he would. Saul was just trying to honor God before going to battle. He was obviously going to have to go to battle. He had to offer a sacrifice to God and worship God. Why shouldn't someone cut him some slack here? Well, first of all, it was well known that not everybody was allowed to officiate at the altar. Therefore, Saul was intruding knowingly into the office of the priesthood. But more than that, he had been specifically told by the prophet of God, a prophet whose words had been, verified by signs, multiple signs, that he was speaking from God. He'd been told to wait 7 days and wait for Samuel to tell him what to do, and Samuel would come and offer the sacrifice. So Saul, his faith was clearly tested, severely tested, and we all of us have failed under tests before, so we can't really personally condemn him. But we can't justify his actions either. He really didn't do what he was told to do. And this may have been a deliberate test to see if he's going to obey God or act on his own, like other kings would do. Other kings would act on their own, but he's under orders to follow the instructions of the prophet of God. And Samuel waiting as long as he did was very possibly a deliberate testing of Saul's obedience, and he, in this case, failed that test. Though no doubt he was well-intentioned, he knew that he was not supposed to do what he did. He just thought, under the circumstances, he had little else that he could do. When Jesus was fasting 40 days in the wilderness, the Bible says his hunger came back. When you fast for 40 days, most of that period of time, you don't feel hungry. It's just something about the physiology of a long fast that your body loses its hunger fairly early on, and you don't get hungry again until the end, when your body is actually starving, when your body has nothing else it can burn as fuel but its own tissues. That's when the hunger returns after a long fast like that. And the Bible says Jesus fasted 40 days, and after 40 days he was hungry, which means he was actually on the verge of dying. At that time, Satan came to him and said, why don't you just turn these rocks into bread? Now, if Satan had come to him earlier, when he was not on the verge of death, when he was not starving to death, and said, why don't you turn these rocks to bread? Jesus might readily have said, well, you know, it's not necessary. I'm not dying. You know, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Certainly God will show up before I starve to death. But when Jesus was actually starving to death, it's like Saul at the, you know, the 7 days had passed. You know, there was no deliverance. Samuel had not shown up. Something's got to be done or else it's going to be a disaster. Jesus could have reasoned that way. He could have thought, well, you know, my father hasn't told me to break the fast yet. I'm supposed to be living by every word that proceeds out of his mouth, and I, you know, he hasn't shown up to give me permission. But if he doesn't come now, I'm going to die, so I might as well act. I mean, that was the temptation. Jesus resisted that temptation, and when he did resist it, the devil left him for a while, and the Bible says the angels came and ministered to him. So God was mindful of his needs, and God did send the angels to meet his needs. But he waited till the last moment of extremity when it seemed like it was almost too late. A lot of times, God will do that. You know, he'll wait till we think it's too late. You know, I would have trusted God up to this point, but now I can just see that it's disaster is around the bend. I've got to act without God on this. And sometimes living by faith for finances is that way. You know, you know there's a bill coming up due, you know there's rent coming up due within a few days, and you're short or, you know, you need something, and the test is, will you, you know, do something on your own? I mean, you don't, if you're living the way that I'm talking about, the way, like George Mueller's way of living, you know, he had a commitment that he would just trust God and not tell people his needs, but many times it came right down to mealtime, and there's no food there. And he was greatly tested, of course, to tell somebody his needs, to ask for money. But he had a commitment that he didn't feel God wanted him to do that. And he, as far as I know, he never failed the test, that test either. In fact, he had a policy that even if they were totally out of money and needing money and didn't know where the next money was coming from, that if someone would walk up and say, Mr. Mueller, I feel like the Lord's told me to make a donation to your ministry. Do you have any needs? He'd say, well, I've made agreement with God. I won't talk about those things with anyone but him. He wouldn't give any indication that he had needs, even though he had them, because he felt God will come through before it's too late. And God always did come through before it was too late, but not much before. Often it was just about the moment that it was going to be too late, and then God came through. And that's how God often will test somebody's faith. I have to say that I have failed that test a few times. Not very many that I can recall. I can think of two or three times in my life living that same way, that almost always the money came just at the last minute, but there were times it seemed like this is the last minute and isn't there. And I let somebody know my need. I borrowed money and I paid it back because the money came in anyway. You know, it would have come in even if I hadn't failed the test. You know, and that's what Samuel would have arrived on time, even if Saul had not moved ahead. He didn't know that, though. Jesus didn't know when the angels would come and minister to him. All he knew is that he's on the verge of death. It seems like God's too late, or almost too late, therefore perhaps I better act on my own. Jesus didn't do that. Saul did. He acted ahead of God, and yet it turned out that Samuel did come on that seventh day, just a few hours later than Saul had run out of faith and patience. And so it happened as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, verse 10, Samuel came and Saul went out to meet him that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you did not come within the days appointed and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. See, that's the thing. A lot of times when we cave in under temptation, it's because we feel compelled. Circumstances seem to require it. You know, how can I hold out and wait for God to show up when the disaster is looming right now? I'm under pressure. And those pressures are just part of the way God deals with people when he's training them and testing them in their faith. Saul was a brand new king. He was untested up to this point. And his special responsibilities as the king of Israel would be that he had to obey God to the letter about everything. And it's not unlike God to put a man to a test this much so that he feels compelled to disobey God or else to trust God. And he says, I just felt compelled. And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. Of course, he's referring to David, though he didn't go out and find David till some chapters later. Then Samuel arose and went up to Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. So of his 2,000, around three quarters had deserted him. Now notice this. Samuel said to Saul, if you had been obedient to God, God would have established your house, your dynasty, in other words, your kingdom, forever. Now, that's the promise he later made to David through Nathan the prophet, that God was going to establish David's house and his seed on the throne forever. Apparently, Saul could have had that with his house instead of David's. God went to seek David because Saul failed. But think of what that means. It certainly tells us that God's plans are conditioned, because apparently if Saul had not failed, then God's plan would have been for the house of Saul to be the kings of Israel forever. But Saul's failure changed the plan. It's like the plans are alterable or conditioned upon our behavior. That's true in general. In fact, we saw that the prophet said that to Eli in chapter 2 and verse 30. He said, the Lord said to Eli, I said to your father and the house of your father that you'd walk before me forever. But now far be it from me, says the Lord, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed. In other words, I made a promise that this would be so in your household forever. That's 1 Samuel 2:30. But it's conditional. There are many promises God has made that have forever attached to them, but they are conditional, whether he mentions it at the time or not. That's just the way he deals. That's why I think it's quite naive for certain people to assume a belief in eternal security based upon certain passages that talk about forever and life eternal and so forth. Well, it's forever, potentially, on the condition of faith, on the condition of your continuing loyalty to God, it's forever. Saul's kingdom would have been forever if he'd been more obedient, but he wasn't, so it's not going to be. God had a change of plan, and he sought another man to establish a forever kingdom. So Samuel rebuked him and left. So Saul is left without the prophet of God, without any confidence that God is on his side. In fact, he's been told that God is upset with him. And he's going to go to battle, having 600 men on his side against this overwhelming army. Saul is left in a very unenviable situation. Verse 16, Saul, Jonathan, his son, and the people who were present with them remained in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Then raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned to the road that leads to Ophrah, to the land of Shual. Another company turned to the road to Beth Horon. And another company turned to the road of the border that overlooks the valley of Zeboim toward the wilderness. So these three raiding companies of the Philistines apparently are moving forward while this enormous army of the Philistines is just hanging back, waiting for the action. They're sending forth some raiding parties to stir up something to see if they can get the Israelites to come out and fight. Now, there was no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make swords and spears. But all the Israelites would go down to the Philistines to sharpen each man's plowshare, his mattock and his axe, and his sickle. And the charge for the sharpening was a pim for the plowshare, the mattocks, the forks, and the axes, and to set the points on the goads. A pim is about two-thirds of a shekel of silver. A shekel of silver would be like a day's wage. So the Philistines would charge 2/3 of a man's day's wage, like if they worked 12 hours a day, which is likely during the sunlight hours, that'd be like 8 hours' wages to sharpen your tools. And yet these tools were apparently the only metal the Israelites had. So we have to assume that when they gathered to fight as an army, they were bringing sickles and axes and plowshares and things like that, whatever metal things they had, which had been sharpened at great expense by the Philistines, but were not really instruments of combat. Now, Jonathan and Saul were the exceptions. For some reason, they were permitted to have swords. I don't know if they were permitted by the Philistines to have swords as a concession, feeling like, you know, two swords against us all, who cares? Or if Saul and Jonathan secretly had swords and the Philistines didn't know it. Because, obviously, there had been some previous battles. There had been some of the enemy fallen. I would think that a nation as unarmed as Israel was would not miss the opportunity to plunder those that were killed in battle of their enemies and take their weapons. So there would be some source of weapons, but not much. So it came about on the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and Jonathan, his son. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. You know, I've often wondered about this. You know, there wasn't a sword or spear in any of these Israelites' hands. Only the two commanders, Saul and his son, had weapons. And the others had what? Sticks and stones and slingshots and pitchforks and what? You know? I guess so, but it just seems weird that that would be so when they have, in fact, had previous battles. They've seen the Philistines routed before them. Certainly they would have had a lot of weapons they could have collected. So where were those weapons? It seems probable that the Philistines, being their overlords, had come and collected their weapons, just like tyrants always want to do. You know, collect the guns. That's what Hitler had to do. He made gun laws to take the guns away from peoples to keep them subservient. Tyrants are smart that way. Apparently the Philistines, although Israel had had an opportunity to collect weapons, never had the power to throw off the Philistine oppression. Therefore, the Philistines could make the rules, which apparently meant you can't keep these weapons. You can beat your weapons into plowshares and your spears into pruning hooks if you want to, but you can't have swords, except Saul and Jonathan. Since he's your tin horn ruler, we'll indulge him and his son with a sword each. So that's how things stand. Essentially unarmed, small band of Israelites, two leaders who each have swords. God is not with them, or at least God has rebuked him. That doesn't mean God's not with them, but Samuel's not with them, giving him guidance, which is what he needed. And so in chapter 14, it says, now it happened one day, apparently during this standoff, when things were not exploding into battle yet, this is how it started. One day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, and the young man who bore his armor, said, come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison on the other side. But he did not tell his father. And this is a shame, because Saul ended up making some foolish vows that ended up complicating things here. And Saul was sitting in the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron. The people who were with him were about 600 men. Now, there's nothing wrong, I'm sure, with a man, even the king, sitting under a pomegranate tree in the shade. He's got to sit somewhere. But it just sounds like such a dereliction of duty, you know? The nation is at war, the enemy is mobilized, and the king with 600 men, we see him sitting. Now, obviously, there's nothing wrong with sitting. Every general at war has times when he sits. So this is not necessarily a criticism of him, but there certainly is a contrast between him and Jonathan. Jonathan is active. Jonathan's aggressive. Jonathan's mobilized. He's eager to engage the enemy. And Saul and his 600 men are kind of just sitting in the shade, not moving. Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's father. Remember Ichabod? He was born the day Eli died. The son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing an ephod, but the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Now, it's interesting here. Ichabod's brother was the priest. Apparently, Ichabod, though he was born of the priest, was not the oldest. the oldest in the family of the priests would be the high priest. Ichabod's brother we had not known about before, but he existed, and now we're told that he was the one wearing the ephod. And it says, the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. Now between the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a sharp rock on one side and a sharp rock on the other side. Obviously a narrow pass between them, probably one that was narrow enough that only one man at a time, or at the most two, could pass through, which made it a rather defensible position for an army of one or two, since the enemy could only come one at a time. And it says, and the name of this was Bozez, and the name of the other was Sinna. That's the names of those two rocks. They named rocks in those days. We do too, I'm sure. We have names for mountains and so forth.
Gibraltar.
Yeah, the Rock of Gibraltar, right. The front of one face northward, opposite Mishmash, and the other southward, opposite Gibeah. Then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that Yahweh will work for us, for nothing restrains Yahweh from saving by many or by few. So his armor-bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart. Go then. Here I am with you, according to your heart. Now his armor-bearer was a stout fellow too. He didn't say, hey, don't you realize there's just two of us and there's a garrison of them over there? You want me to put my neck on the line like that? Well, he just said, whatever you want, I'm with you. I got your back. You lead, I'll follow you, and we'll just take our fate into our hands and let Yahweh decide the outcome. Then Jonathan said, very well, let us cross over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. If they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. But if they say to us, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. So it's kind of like Gideon's fleece. How do we know if God's going to deliver the enemy into our hands? Well, we'll look for this sign. Although this was not so much a miraculous sign, Gideon was asking for something that would be an obvious miracle. The fleece being wet and the ground dry, or the fleece being dry and the ground wet. But this was not so much a miracle, it was more a matter of, you couldn't predict which reaction the Philistines would have. Would they say, well, you stand there until we come over to you, or would they say, you come over here? And Jonathan, if it's this way, then we're not going to assume that we're going to fight them. We can just pretend like we're defectors or something. But if they say, come over to us, then we go with guns blazing, because God has delivered them into our hands, we're going to take them. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden. Mocking the fact that the Israelites have been cowards, maybe in fact thinking of these to be a couple of defectors from Saul's army, not knowing who they were. Then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, come up to us, and we will show you something. So Jonathan said to his armor-bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor-bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. And as he came after them, his armor-bearer killed them. So Jonathan knocked them down, and his armor-bearer came back behind him and killed him. I don't know if Jonathan was using a club and his armor-bearer was using his sword or whatever, but it was a two-stroke kill for each of these Philistines. Jonathan knocked him down, probably maybe knocked him out or disabled him, and the armor-bearer killed him off. And so this is how they killed all of them. 20 men they killed. The first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. And there was trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked, so that it was a very great trembling. Notice how often we read this, that the earth quaked, when it's really talking about people trembling. Just a note. This is the way the Hebrew poetry or idiom speaks. The reason that's important is because we read of earthquaking in a lot of prophetic passages too. And some people, not knowing the Hebrew idiom, just assume this is talking about literal earthquakes. Where in fact, the earthquaking is often referred to as something that is, of course, not the earth wasn't really shaking. It's as if it was. People were trembling so violently, it's as if they would shake the earth itself, is basically how this is intended. And so now the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away. That is the multitude of the Philistines. And they went here and there. So Saul's at some distance. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't know Jonathan's out there. He just sees the watchmen. You know, the Philistines are kind of running away from something. We don't know from what, but the Philistines are running away. And so Saul is, of course, encouraged and decides he better take advantage of the situation. And Saul said to the people who were with him, "Now call the roll and see who has gone from us." And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. Apparently they had all been together at one point, and Jonathan and his armor bearer had snuck off to do this thing without telling his father. And Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For at that time the ark of God was with the children of Israel. This means, of course, it had come back. I don't know if it's saying that it wasn't with them at the time the writer wrote. If the writer is saying that the ark of God was not with them at the time of his writing, and it was in the time of the story he's telling, then we'd have to have this writer writing after the Babylonian exile. That's when the ark was permanently lost to Israel. And a writer after that time might say, well, back then they had the ark with them, you know. However, it's not likely that this was written quite so late as that. And so it's probably referring to the fact that the ark had at one time been taken from them by the Philistines, but now had returned. So it was with them again at this time, as opposed to how it had been at a former time. Now it happened while Saul talked to the priest that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. And Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Now, withdraw the hand, it's hard to know what that means. In fact, it's hard to know what the priest was doing. The priest was supposed to be inquiring of the Lord, no doubt. So it's probable he was putting his hand into the breastplate to pull out the Urim and the Thummim and to get some guidance from God. Why the ark had to be brought as well, I don't know. It's possible that since Samuel wasn't there, the next best symbol of God's presence other than the prophet himself would be the ark. And so Saul needed to have some kind of encouragement that somehow God was with them. So the ark came and the priest. And probably the priest was, we don't know exactly how the Urim and the Thummim work, but many people think it was these two stones in the bag that he wore on his chest the priest would pull out, and somehow they would tell the mind of God. There's a great deal of speculation as to how this worked. But when Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand," apparently what he meant was, we're running out of time. We need to strike with iron hot. We don't have time to consult God about this right now. We just have to move. Same mistake he had made earlier. Then Saul and the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle. And indeed, every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. That is, the Philistines, their swords were against each other. This is a very common thing that God did often in order to save Israel from their enemies. And that was just when Israel was outnumbered or when they were not armed so well as their enemies, God would often just use their enemies to kill their enemies. You know, the enemies would kill each other. This is what happened in Gideon's battle. When Gideon attacked the Midianites, the Bible says that God turned the Midianites against each other and they were killing each other. At a later date, when over 1 million people of the enemies of Israel came against Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, God told him that he should not fear these great armies because the battle was the Lord's, and that Jehoshaphat should just send the musicians out and the priests to worship the Lord. So they did. They sent their musicians out to worship the Lord on the battlefield, and it says the Lord turned the enemies against each other and they killed each other off. So it's a really common strategy of God to show that it's not by Israel's might that their security lies. God can just make the enemy kill each other off, which is really kind of an insane thing to do, but God just turns them crazy and confused. The word confusion is used in these cases. The enemy gets confused. They don't know who's the enemy and who's not. Now, that takes some real crazy confusion to not know that the guy who's armed in the same armor you're wearing is on your side. They went kind of crazy. And, you know, the devil doesn't really have much ingenuity of his own. We give him credit for being wise, but he really just copies other things. He's not very creative. And his greatest strategy against Christians is one he borrowed from God, the one that God used against Israel's enemies. Make them think that they are each other's enemy and kill each other off. Then the devil doesn't have to do anything to them. Just get the Christians to fight among themselves. And then it just neutralizes their effectiveness and their power against the enemy. And so we see that this is what Satan does. We don't have any direct persecution against us in this country. I mean, maybe we do a little bit, but not as much as is normal. But we have divisiveness. The highest concentration of evangelicals probably in the world is probably in North America. And think of what could be accomplished by a spiritual force that large if they were united, if they were devoted, if they were marching shoulder to shoulder against the enemy. But the devil knows that, and he's done some really interesting things in causing crazy divisions, divisions that are insane. People who are friends splitting up, marriages splitting up, churches splitting up over trivial things. The hand of Satan in it is so evident because it's irrational. But I just think the devil just learned that strategy from God, because God has used that strategy in defeating Israel's enemies. Divide and conquer and get the enemy to kill each other off. Then Israel doesn't have to have weapons. What do they need weapons for? They don't have to fight. And if the church just divides and fights each other, then Satan's side doesn't have to even be armed. They can just sit back under a pomegranate tree if they want to and just watch the battle go by. Watch us undermine our own objectives. This is what God did to the Philistines. There was great confusion. Every man's sword was against his neighbor. Moreover, verse 21, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up to them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. Now, these were apparently Israelite defectors. Remember, there had been thousands with Saul, but then when they saw the hordes of Philistines, they decided they knew what side of the bread the butter was on. This was not going to go over for Israel. I think I'll defect to the other side. Maybe they won't be too hard on me. You know, if I'm standing with Saul, I'm going to be someone they're shooting at. If I come over to their side, they'll probably be more merciful. So there had been Hebrews who had defected to the Philistines, but now they were encouraged by seeing what Jonathan had initiated and the victory that God was giving them. So they came back over. So the forces of Israel swelled a little bit within their ranks. Likewise, all the men of Israel who had hidden in the mountains of Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, they also followed hard after them in battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle shifted to Beth-Aven. Now, the story is not over. It sounds like that's the end of it. There's some little details that have to be told here in the next verses that took place during the battle. But this is a summary. God turned the battle and the victory to Israel. Not because of Saul. Saul had been disobedient to God, but because his son Jonathan was a man of faith and power and boldness and courage. Jonathan trusted God, and Saul, he was just sitting around watching it happen under the pomegranate tree or whatever. Now, what's interesting about this is the influence that one man's faith or one man's courage can have on a demoralized group of God's people. Here, there were people who had actually defected to the enemy. And there were people who had not defected to the enemy, but had hidden because they were terrified. They didn't want to go to battle against the enemy. And then there were the trembling troops that had stayed with Saul. All these people were useless. There was an enemy to be defeated. There were objectives to gain. There was liberty to be obtained for Israel. And all these people were useless. Some of them actually had defected and become traitors. Others were just useless, neutralized by fear, by discouragement, by the assumption that we can't win. And then here, Jonathan and his armor bearer, two guys only, they decide, I think we can win. If God's on our side, we can win this. And they go out and step out in faith, and they have such good results that suddenly all the discouraged ones, they decide to come out and be encouraged and join the battle too. And that is no doubt an encouragement to us to think that we live in times where Christians have, many have backslidden. Some of them are just hiding out and doing nothing for God, afraid to speak up, afraid to make the culture angry at them, afraid to engage the enemy. But one person, yourself maybe, by actually breaking that curve and being the one who just decides to trust God and move forward and change things, can encourage others to do the same thing. And then you'd be surprised what a movement can be started. You know, one person who's going to be uncompromising, one person who's going to speak out for God in a situation where others are afraid to speak out and so forth. And then others who have been afraid previously or been discouraged, you know, they see God begin to move and they step forward too, and suddenly there's more resources doing the same thing. And any one of us could possibly be someone that God would use that way. When you're in a compromised time where the churches are really just not confronting the enemy at all, they're just kind of digging in and trying to preserve their gains, and then one person who stands up and says, but we're going to follow Jesus in an uncompromising way, and we're going to speak up about what we're supposed to speak up about, and we're not going to be afraid of the culture or afraid of the enemy, it encourages people eventually. Sometimes people just say, yeah, you know, that's what I thought too. I just never heard anyone else saying it, so I'm just really was afraid. Not everyone really likes Rush Limbaugh and his personality and so forth, but one thing that is obvious about Rush Limbaugh is that he was the first of the people who are political conservatives in this country to really come out on the radio and start, you know, just being in the face of the liberal media, which was everybody else but him at the time. I remember hearing people say, you know, he's saying what I always thought, but I never heard anyone else say it, so I didn't know anyone else thought it, you know, and I just kept my ideas to myself. But when he came out and began to speak certain things, those who had always thought that way but felt intimidated by the seeming liberal majority found out that they weren't in the minority after all. They were just the silent majority. They were the silent ones who were afraid to speak up. But as soon as there became somebody speaking up, they said they felt affirmed. They felt like, wow, I'm not the Lone Ranger here. I'm not the only person who thinks this way. And there's become a very vocal conservative movement. And I don't say that in order to promote either Rush Limbaugh or the conservative movement necessarily, because I don't agree with everything that's in those movements or in Rush's program. I'm just saying that there's a phenomenon that you can see of how one man finally speaking up against what everyone else is saying causes other people to come out of the woodwork and say, you know, I always felt that way too. I just didn't know anyone else did. And so those who are hiding in their caves come on out and join in the fray. And I'm not necessarily trying to equate, you know, the political battles between conservatism and liberalism with something necessarily spiritual, although there are spiritual aspects to it. I'm just saying that Jonathan is the guy who, because he moved forward, he stepped out, he went public, he joined the battle when no one else was doing it. Suddenly all the people who agreed with him but were afraid to say so came out, and then, of course, there was more of a considerable movement. Now, verse 24. And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under an oath. This is something that happened earlier that we had not heard about. Saying, cursed is the man who eats any food until evening before I have taken vengeance on my enemies. So none of the people tasted food. Now, notice Saul. He's really grandstanding here, you know. I'm going to take vengeance against my enemies. Well, he hadn't even been willing to engage the enemy. And it's not his enemies, it's the enemies of Israel and of the Lord. It's not the personal enemies of Saul. It's not like he's got some personal glory to vindicate here. He's kind of making himself the guy who, this is all about me. You know, this is about me because I'm the king. These people are my enemies. I'm going to avenge myself. Although he hadn't really done much to do anything in this battle. His son had done all the work so far. But Saul, wanting to inspire people with a sense of devotion to God and to the duty, had proclaimed a fast and a curse on anyone who eats food until evening. Well, that's not a really good time to be fasting when you're chasing enemies for hours and fighting. And, you know, it's like, it's good to fast at times, but it's not very smart to proclaim a fast on a day of really active exertion, especially when that active exertion is not just winning a sports event, but winning your country's freedom against enemies and saving your life against enemies. It was just a foolish thing for Saul to do. He just did it in a moment of excitement as he saw, well, something's happening. It looks like things are going our way. We're going to honor God by fasting. Now, there's better times to do that. So no one of the people tasted food. Now all the people of the land came to the forest, and there was honey on the ground. This is as they're pursuing the Philistines. They're chasing them through a forest. There's apparently a beehive there low to the ground somewhere, and honey was dripping on the ground. And when the people had come into the woods, there was the honey dripping. That would have given them some calories and some energy that they needed, but no one put his hand to his mouth because the people feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard his father charge the people with the oath. Therefore, he stretched out the end of the rod that was in his hand and dipped it in the honeycomb and put his hand to his mouth, and his countenance brightened. That is, you know, he's getting exhausted. It kind of gave him a second wind, brightened his face up, like, wow, now I'm feeling I can go another 10 hours of this, you know, where I was running out of steam, but this was really a good thing to have this honey. Then one of the people said, "Your father strictly charged the people with an oath, saying, 'Cursed is the man who eats food this day.'" And the people were faint. But Jonathan said, "My father has troubled the land. Look now how my countenance has brightened because I tasted a little of this honey. How much better if the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies, which they found." That is, when they drove the Philistines out, the Philistines left their camps with all their food and provisions there. Israel could have eaten those things and been strengthened and energized for even greater victory. But instead, because of the Saul putting them under oath, they leave all this food behind while they're hungry, and they're faint. And he says, "For now, would not there not have been a much greater slaughter among the Philistines? Now they had driven back the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon. So the people were very faint. And the people rushed on the spoil." This is after sundown, apparently, when the evening had come, so now they could eat. "So they rushed on the spoils, the sheep, the oxen, the calves, and slaughtered them on the ground. But the people ate them with the blood." That is, they're so ravenous, they didn't wait, as the Jews were supposed to do, to drain all the blood out of the animal. That takes a while, by the way. It's not like they just couldn't wait for the food to be prepared. This, you have to drain out the blood for some hours. You hang the carcass of the animal, and the blood drains out slowly. Eventually, it's drained out, then it's clean, because the Jews could not eat anything with blood in it. These people weren't willing to wait the hours it took to drain the blood out, so they just cooked it up as it was and ate things with the blood. Then they told Saul, saying, "Look, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a large stone to me this day." And Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, 'Bring me here every man's ox and every man's sheep. Slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood.'" So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night, and they slaughtered it there, that is, under supervision, to make sure that it was drained before they ate it. And Saul built an altar to the Lord, and this was the first altar that he built to the Lord. So the offerings he had offered prematurely at Gilgal must have been on an existing altar. This is the first time he actually built a new altar someplace. And Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light, and let us not leave a man of them." And they said, "Do whatever seems good to you." Then the priest said, "Let us draw near to God here." So Saul asked counsel of God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you deliver them into the hand of Israel?" But he did not answer him that day. God wouldn't answer. And Saul said, "Come over here, all you chiefs of the people, and know and see what this sin was today. For as the Lord lives, who saves Israel, though it be Jonathan my son, he shall surely die." But not a man among all the people answered him. So Saul was unaware that Jonathan had broken the oath. Jonathan had been unaware of the oath when he did. There's not very much communication going on. Their walkie-talkies apparently were down that day, and so they weren't able to really get the information out to everybody. So Jonathan had innocently broken the oath. Saul didn't know about it, and so he makes another stupid oath and says, "Well, whoever is responsible for the violation today, they'll surely die, even if it's Jonathan, my son." Now, saying that did not mean that he suspected that it was Jonathan, his son. He's just saying, I don't care what the rank is of the person, he's going down because he's caused God not to want to talk to me. There's a reason why God is not answering us, and it must be there's sin in the camp, and I don't care who it is. Saul had a way of kind of over speaking, and he was just, you know, saying, it could be anybody, it could be my own son, and he'll die. Well, of course, little did he know that his son was the one. And it says, then he said to all Israel, you be on one side, my son Jonathan and I will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do it seems good to you. Therefore Saul said to the Lord God of Israel, give a perfect lot. So Saul and Jonathan were taken in the casting of lots. But the people escaped. So Saul and Jonathan were on one side, the people on the other side, and the lot was to decide, was the offense on the side of the rulers or on the side of the people? And it turned out to be on the side of the rulers. Jonathan and Saul were on one side, and they were singled up. So the people escaped. They were absolved. Then Saul said, cast lots between my son Jonathan and me. So Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. This is almost exactly like the identification of Achan in the book of Joshua, how someone was at fault, and so one tribe was taken, then one clan was taken, one family, then one person was taken. And then when it was identified who it was, Joshua said, taken, you know, give glory to God, confess what you've done. So here's Saul saying, okay, Jonathan, you're the one who's guilty. Tell me what you've done. And Jonathan told him and said, I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand. So now I must die? And Saul answered, God do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. Again, Saul just being extreme. Of course, he had sworn, apparently, that whoever it was would die. But it was a stupid oath, like Jephthah's oath. In this case, though, while Jephthah kept his oath, Saul got talked out of it. So Saul's a little wishy-washy on the character side. But the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished his great salvation in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. Then Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Now, no doubt, Saul was probably relieved not to have to kill his son Jonathan. But he only acquiesced to it under the pressure from the people, and realized that the people would not cooperate with Saul, would not let him kill his son. Saul is making this profound oath, may God do more to me, so to me and more, if I don't kill you, Jonathan. And then the people talking about him says, oh, okay, no, I won't. You know, it's like he didn't take his oath as seriously as people like Jephthah did, because he wasn't a man who was stable. He wasn't a man committed to honesty, apparently, and keeping his word. It says, so Saul established his sovereignty over Israel and fought against his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the people of Ammon, against Edom, the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he harassed them. And he gathered an army and attacked the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them. That story is told in the next chapter. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan and Jishui and Malchishua, and the names of his two daughters were these. The name of the firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger was Michal. Of course, Michal became married to David later on. These three sons that are mentioned would be in addition to Ishbosheth, who maybe was not born yet at this time. But this is kind of a summary statement of Saul's conquest. It mentions his conquest of the Amalekites. Like I said, the details of that are given in chapter 15. It says in verse 50, the name of Saul's wife was Ahinoam, the daughter of Ahimaaz, and the name of the commander of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now there was a fierce war with the Philistines all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any strong man or any valiant man, he took him for himself. So he was a collector of valiant men for his bodyguard or for his army, and of course that is one way that David came to his attention. His scouts, his talent scouts, as it were, his recruiters had gone out and seen that Jesse had a stalwart son that had potential. But he had not been recruited yet, perhaps because he was too young at the time. But we'll find out later on. We've run a little over time, so we're going to stop here.